It's got to be
Hello everybody, my name is Tim Cohen. I'm with two other people, which we are very excited about. One, of course, is Fred. We're always excited because...
Hello!
This is Fred DeFris, well-known musical commentator and writer and general music knowledgeable. Also, we have a guest today, Fionnuala, who is, among many other things, a very well-renowned poet and a literary figure.
Shall I do a little introduction?
Please go ahead.
Fionnuala Darling was born in Cape Town. She has recorded in both her fiction and poetry. She has taught English at the University of South Africa and the University of Cape Town, as well as other institutions, but now works as a freelance writer and creative writing teacher. Her five collections of poetry include Pretend You Don't Know Me and a new and selected volume that brings together many of her most popular poems. Her sixth novel, The Man Who Loved Crocodile Tamers, was published in 2022. But I want to add that she and her writing are often witty, funny, self-deprecating, sometimes serious, often irreverent, and I think it's largely autobiographical, but I might be wrong there, but I think there's lots of autobiographical elements in your writing, both your poetry and your fiction. It also doesn't tell us that her style is elegant and her writing eloquent, nor does it mention that her favorite writer is Jane Austen. So that's what I wanted to add. And maybe you want to add something as well, Fionnuala.
No, Fred, I think that it's always difficult to sum up a very long life, but it has just been devoted to teaching and trying to support this career as a writer. And of course, poetry fits rather oddly into that because it offers no support. And yet, in a way, it's the backbone of my life. Yeah. There wouldn't have been any novels if there hadn't been poetry to start with.
And there's going to be a new poetry book, I understand.
I'm working on a novel, I have been writing some new poetry. I think I experienced a bit of poetry writing block. What happens is that when you write novels, the novel is kind of like a bully. It wants all the space and it wants to be all full of prose, sentences and paragraphs. Poetry is much more elusive and I think I'd frightened it away. And so that's why I'm really interested in our theme today.
Yes, explain the theme to the listeners.
Poets are famous for taking drugs in order to release them into writing poetry. Drugs aren't always an option and alcohol certainly doesn't work when it comes to composing poetry. I find that music does the same thing. It takes you into an altered state. It takes you away from the mundane and the everyday and the cliched. It gives you permission. A lot of the music we're going to play today has this sense of abandonment about it. Just go with your feelings. And so that's switching off the rational brain and just going with intuition and the unconscious. It's really hard. There's so many inhibitions against that. The songs I picked today, there are other songs I could have picked, but they sort of representative in different ways of how music helps me to overcome the blocks.
So shall I read out what you wanted for the theme? So it was songs that helped me lose my inhibitions, songs where the singer has an absolute distinctive voice, songs that aren't afraid of sadness, and songs with inescapable rhythms and memorable imagery and quotable lines. That's the full theme for today.
Fantastic. I wanted to know, do you listen to music while you are writing poetry, or is it too much of a distraction? In some ways, I would say music doesn't help you at all. It sort of competes in the same way that your novel is competing with your poetry at the moment.
Yeah, I think you're right. This period of writer's block that I spoke about that pained me recently, I overcame that by listening to all of Nina Simone and then listening to it again and Dylan. And so what will often happen is something like Dylan's Series of Dreams, I'll play a song like that, or a Queen song, you know, like a really big Freddie Mercury, I'm out there and this is me and you have to accept me, one of those kind of anthems that he sings. And that releases me. I think I can find my inner Freddie Mercury, my inner Bob Dylan. They're kind of setting an example for you. So I can switch the music off then and write the poem. But I've entered the state that the song has provided.
Okay, the Bob Dylan song you were talking about is actually one of your choices. Let's have a listen.
A figure of a series of dreams where nothing comes up to the top. Everything stays down where it's wounded. And come to a permanent stop. Wasn't thinking of anything specific. Like in a dream where someone wakes up and screams. Nothing too very scientific. Just thinking of a series of dreams. Thinking of a series of dreams.
But I have to congratulate you. There are very few Bob Dylan songs I've never heard before, and this is one of them. I always considered myself a complete expert. I'm always irritating Fred by choosing Bob Dylan songs for this podcast. Tell us a little bit about the song and why you like it.
Well, I was married to a Bob Dylan expert. Guy Willoughby used to give lectures on Bob Dylan. So Bob Dylan was always playing in our home. This certainly wasn't his favorite song. He preferred the rowdier ones. But when he got this one, which was an outtake from Oh Mercy, I completely fell in love with it. What happens to me with this song is it changes my heartbeat and it seems to change the rhythm in my mind. I'm no longer a person who is working everything out in tables and diagrams and ticking off a to-do list. I immediately go with him. I get swept into that world of dreams. I think it's the insistent, inescapable drumming and bass. It changes my heartbeat. It changes the way I'm thinking. I can almost imagine if someone were testing my brain that the waves would look different when I'm listening to this song. You can't escape from the world of dreams that this song takes you into. And the song kind of gives you permission to work with dreams and unrelated images, which is where poetry comes from. It's this connection you make between, I mean, what is the connection between a folded umbrella and everything stays down where it's wounded, and this image of people being wounded and kind of cowering? I think that it's this great, mainly it's just the great flood of his unconscious, that he's letting his subconscious have full play. He's saying to it, you have the stage. And I think it's almost like Dylan is showing us what the process of creation is. It is allowing the whole full flow and flood of imagery to come out.
Great description. I think one of the amazing things about Dylan and poetry is he does have one special skill that is, it's not always in poetry, but it's associated with poetry, and that's the most amazing rhyming ability. I mean, his rhymes are just beautiful. Just let me read one paragraph of the lyrics. I wasn't looking for any special assistance, not going to any great extremes. I'd already gone the distance. I was just thinking of a series of dreams. I mean, it's just like, wow. Don't you think? Fred, you're not wowed by Dylan's poetic ability.
No. I once read that he when he was young, he read the Surrealists and he copied a lot of the images from them. You know, things that don't seem to make sense together, etc. So, no, he's a very good poet. And I didn't know this song either. I just read that it actually did appear on the 100 greatest Bob Dylan songs that Rolling Stone chose in 2015. and it became number 81, which is quite something for a song that wasn't officially recorded till much later than it was supposed to be recorded or re-released. I mean, he made so many good songs.
Yeah. This session was obviously made a very deep impression on Dylan. He wrote a lot about it in his biography, about this particular session, and ultimately said he was very disappointed that he wasn't able to give Jacques Levy, the producer, any sort of great track. And it wasn't a breakout album. It was a very odd album, from my point of view, for Dylan to focus on in his biography, because he didn't write about any other recording session in anything close to that deep level of detail. But apparently they fought over the song, and that's why it's off the record. Well, Jacques Levy wanted it differently, and Bob Dylan didn't want
it. It's Daniel Lenoir, right?
Yeah, sorry, did I pronounce that wrong?
Well, I don't know how you pronounce it. But apparently they also had a sort of love-hate relationship. I once read somewhere that at some stage Lenoir was imitating Dylan to the other members of the band, you know, like imitating his voice and the way he speaks. And then Dylan walked in hearing that Lenoir was imitating him, and he got very, very angry. So I think there was a lot of tension between the two of them. And in the end, I think he was happy with the result, Dylan, but that was the last time, as far as I know, that they worked together.
That they worked together.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on to one of Dylan's great friends. This is Fred's first choice. That's Patti Smith, Ain't It Strange. Fred, a fabulous song. Why does it fit this category, would you argue?
I like Patti Smith a lot. And I could have picked, I don't know how many songs that sort of would do it for me. When it's her voice and the sort of like she goes way beyond form and beyond control. And on this song, not so much in this bit that you just heard, but later on she goes into that sort of, what would you call it? Like the Turkish dance, you know, the one that swirls and swirls and swirls.
Yeah, the dervish.
She does it with words and she improvises. And I think she's at a different level of consciousness when she gets into that space. And she sort of reminds me of freedom, like complete freedom when she does that. And there are no rules. You just do what you want to do and you do it as best as you can. And she has a way with words, of course. I mean, this song, can I read you a bit from... There's a book called Why Patti Smith Matters by a woman called Karen Rose. And she writes about this song. Ain't It Strange, with its dark and mystical scenes, is one of Patti's best songs. Well, there you go. She used to like to tell stories about Shiraz Riot on stage, pulling from her childhood love of Arabian Nights. And here she is telling a story about the hidden, the sacred, the secret, but she's also inhibiting a character. It brings Eastern mysticism, hand of God, I start to whirl, is right out of Rumi, and the whirling dervishes. Oh, there you are, the dervishes. Then there's a one drop in the rhythm. Richard levitates an organ. Lenny sings harmonies, and Ivan's guitar solo feels like a dry desert wind, a scirocco blowing through the palace. It is meant to be dangerous and seductive, and it succeeds. I'm amazed when it appears in current set list because it still maintains all its essential elements, and in many ways, it's more powerful now. So there you go. I mean, she said it all for me. So I love it. I mean, I also like Pissing in a River, which is from the same album, Radio Ethiopia, which wasn't her most successful album, I think. You know, she made the first album, Horses, and then she got elevated to the status of Queen of Punk or whatever you want to call it. And then Radio Ethiopia had a very long track, Improvisation, wasn't very of its day when songs should be short and sharp and to the point. But I love Patti Smith, and I think this is, you know, it always makes me sort of happy, energetic and powerful, which is, I think, what Finula meant when she wanted us to choose these songs.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love Patti Smith. I'm so glad you chose this. And I love her also, you know, how she embodies her music. You know, that was what I was looking for, was singer-songwriters who kind of aren't scared to put themselves right there in the song. And you can hear her voice. It's on the edge of desperation. And I think the way the whole song insists on a mood of transcendence, of an altered state, I mean, that would be very helpful to me. If I were writing a poem and I was hearing it, I'd think, yes, Patti's showing you something here.
And it starts off as a sort of conventional, slightly reggae-ish song, but then it develops into something completely different later on. And I think on stage she does, every time she does it, it's going to be much different, which is also interesting. You know, you keep doing it and keep making it changes. And she's not a formulaic songwriter, let's put it that way. And I love her voice. I think she's got a very strong voice.
Yeah, and she did. I mean, she started her career as a poet and, you know, performing live. And she sort of carried that forward into her music. It's just so beautiful. You know why I love Patti Smith? It's very kind of not on topic at all, but Bob Dylan gets the Nobel Prize. So what does he do? First of all, he doesn't go and pick it up. He sends Patti Smith to go and pick it up for him. They ask Patti Smith to sing Bob Dylan's song, which he agrees to do, right? So she's in there in the hall in which all the Nobel Prize winners are awarded their prize. And she sings Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, the most uncomplicated Bob Dylan song that you've ever heard. And she just breaks down in the middle of it and says, I'm so sorry, I'm just so nervous. I mean, I can't believe that Patti Smith, I was just astounded that Patti Smith, of all people, should be nervous in any situation. It was just such a fantastic moment of vulnerability. It seems so human for somebody who I've always thought of as just completely invulnerable. I just liked her so much more after that.
And it wasn't an affectation, was it?
She just froze. And then she started again and she sang the whole song.
Well, the lyrics a bit.
Yes, yeah, that's right. Anyway, all right, let's move on. This is my first song.
The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
All right, so this is Gil Scott-Heron with his most famous song, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, you know, published way, way, way back in the 80s. I've always been interested in the intersection between poetry and music. For some reason or other, I've been listening to a lot of rap. If you trace rap back to its origins, you would have to go to Gil Scott-Heron. He's really the grandfather of the whole process of putting verbal presentation to a musical background and then letting the words actually do the work. So the melody is not operating here for you. And this particularly, the confidence with which he presents it, the wonderful sort of jazzy background, and also the kind of free verse style, he's just too cool. I mean, the guy's too cool. And he uses this wonderful kind of repetitive technique that goes right through the song. And then right at the end, he blasts you with "The Revolution Will Be Live." You know, it's just, I don't know, it's struck me as the kind of music that would really make you want to investigate the power of expression and the power of words. What do you think? Am I completely off the mark?
Yeah. I think it's It's a great piece of rhetoric. And that line, I mean, that's what I'm, you know, would always be looking for, would be a memorable line, like the revolution will not be televised, it will be live. And I think it's that long catalogue of negatives, it won't be this, and it won't have the advert played afterwards, and it won't. So for me, what I think is this is not really a piece of music. For me, this is a poem with some kind of a bit of music in the background, possibly added later. Just feels that way to me. And I also think that it's so satirical in some ways. I mean, it's got this big challenge inside the voice, and because it's such a bravura performance.
Yes, yes.
But it's a very, very in-your-face political one as well. Whereas Dylan and Patti Smith were much more esoteric.
This is, you know, I think this is the height of the kind of leftism in popular music.
It was 1970 when he wrote it.
Yes, that's right.
So that was just after, you know, all the turmoil, the racial riots. And apparently he wrote it as a response to a tune by The Last Poets, who were also around that time. And they had a song which opens with the line, "When the revolution comes, some of us will probably catch it on TV." So it's proto-rap, where people also respond to each other's songs and pick a line and then run away with it and come with something new, which is very interesting, I think.
Yeah. I also think it gets power. This is, you know, one of my, the songs that I've chosen seem to have been associated with sad people. Because, you know, he brought this album out, gained enormous respect and notoriety, and then just disappeared into drugs for years. He was arrested several times for possession, spent two periods in jail, came out and was, you know, he did bring out a sort of final album, which I thought was lovely, but he was a shadow of his former self. And then he died very soon afterwards.
He wrote a book.
People who die are you know, you just have to respect them a little bit more.
I'll remember that.
Yes. But he did write a book as well, which apparently was very, very good. A friend of mine read it and he said it was an astounding book. It was a sort of autobiography, I guess, about his dark past and how he sank into that hole. It's so sad. So many people of that era, particularly, because there was no real help if you were a drug addict. You know, these days they go to rehab and they come out 6 weeks later and they go back again and they go back into rehab. But those days, that was it. You were a drug addict and you sort of low life and you had to survive on the street and that was the end of it, basically.
Yeah. And he also got HIV because, you know, it wasn't just that he was taking, you know, he wasn't taking lightweight drugs. He was taking heavyweight drugs. All right, well, let's move on to a much more positive approach to life. This is Nina Simone.
My father always promised me that we would live.
So that's Nina Simone with My Father.
My daughter always used to get upset with me for playing this song so much. She said, "It's so sad, Mommy. You can't listen to it." But that was exactly why I loved it. It is, to me, it is such a huge, lush, invitation to any feelings of melancholy and nostalgia, you know, the drawn out time and the sadness of a father who promises his daughter something that he can't as a miner ever hope to give her. That whole sense of the fundamental thing about poetry, you wouldn't be able to write poetry at all unless you were full of memories. And this, for me, this song is just a reminder of that. And also that the archetypal poem, the poem you kind of, you almost de rigueur have to write as a poet, is at least one poem about your father. I don't know if it's the same for songwriters, if they feel the same obligation, but certainly for poets, the father and mother poems must be there in the corpus. And she does this so, so splendidly. I sail my memories of home like boats across the Seine. And also just that the song moves from the promise of Paris as a child when her father was a miner to the reality of Paris. I live in Paris now. And sort of the change in her life.
Cool. Well, actually, strangely enough, here is a singer who matches, in my humble opinion, Nina Simone.
It, Funula.
Yeah?
You asked for a sad song. I found you my favorite sad song.
It is. She's got such a sad, sad voice. And that insistent pair of piano notes, which you can't escape from, but I kept wanting it to resolve itself into something.
And it doesn't.
It won't.
All right, so that's Cat Power, maybe not. It does satisfy your requirements in some ways of songs that transport you. What I've always liked about Cat Power is she's got this sort of natural sadness about her kind of singing tone. But actually, I find her really uplifting. I don't know, I find her really, there's something so beautiful, you know, just purely beautiful about her vocal control and the way and the how she sort of presents songs, that I always come away, I just listen to these songs over and over again just to pick up the tiniest little morsel of her of her style. What do you think?
Yeah, I find her voice quite sort of breathy and over feminine, like, oh, I'm a girl, so I'm going to keep my voice nice and husky and soft, whereas I want a big Tom Waits woman voice. But I like the lyrics very much. I like the lyrics, kind of that message about freedom, and we all do what we can. You know, if I were sitting thinking, oh, I can't write a poem, and I just heard a lyric like, we all do what we can, it's just do what you can. It's all you have to say to yourself when you sit in front of a blank page. You don't have to be Byron or Keats or anybody. You just do what you can. So I do like that. I like the spirit behind the song, but the voice itself, not so much.
Oh, Finula, now we are no longer friends, I'm afraid. Tim once wrote a piece for the Mail and Guardian about the best song ever written. You picked a Bob Dylan song, obviously. And then I thought, well, I'll copy that idea. And I wrote a piece for Vrije Weekblad about the best song ever written. And I picked this song. I mean, it still brings me to tears. I don't feel any morsel of happiness listening to this. I mean, it's like complete depression. It's, you can't get any lower than this. And I, even now, you know, I sort of get tears in my eyes when I hear it for the, I don't know how many time, but it's, and I don't find her voice. I mean, a lot of these new girl singers have sort of feminine voices. I mean, like Taylor Swift has a very light. I don't think Cat Power has that, what you just described, to be honest.
I'd like it to be covered by Tracy Chapman.
No, I don't.
I mean, Fred, you said that you don't find any lift out of the song, but don't you, as Fionnuala was saying, don't you find this, you know, this sort of trying to be free, the whole idea of a somewhat struggling and difficult attempt to express yourself, don't you find that uplifting? I thought it was as Fionnuala does.
We just do the best we can. I went through a bad patch in my life when I heard this song, so this always brings that back. I guess that's probably also plays a big role in it. And I think Nina Simone, if she covered this song, you probably would have had the absolute best ever song. Not Tracy Chapman, sorry. So you also know where my vote will go to this evening, this morning, this afternoon.
All right, let's move on. This is a guy called Nick Cave.
Lushing in the waking elbow, crushed his brother's head in with a ball. It's my great privilege. Sunday rain. Hop inside my coat.
This is Nick Cave. The song is called Frogs. It's just come out. I was just listening to a couple of Nick Cave songs because he's one of the great poets of our age, I think. I just wondered what song would work for this session. Then I came across this brand new song, which I never heard before. I thought, wow, you know, that is very Nick Cave and very good. I mean, I don't know whether it's just the greatest song ever, but I was just taken by the fact that it has just been released. I mean, he does have this thing about protection and being embraced and covered. And it's an interesting sort of subtopic for him. I mean, one of his great songs, I always tell the story that one of his great songs is called The Ship Song, and it's about bring your ships within the harbor, you know, the same sort of idea about protection. And a friend of mine, he wanted to propose. So he sat down his prospective wife and said, you've got to listen to the song. They listened to the song together. And then after the song was finished, he said, will you marry me? And she said, yes, of course, but why did you play that awful song? So, you know, not everybody's taste, Mr. Nick Cave.
No, someone could definitely propose to me with Nick Cave. I love Nick Cave. I'm so glad I hadn't heard this song. I think what I just love about it is that sense of ecstasy. You know, he kind of gets into, that state of wonder and, you know, amazed to be in the rain, amazed to be in water again. Amazed at the pain, and that tone of his voice, you know, I suppose like all along what I'm thinking about is poetry is so connected to voice. You are not a poet if you don't have a voice that is your own, and he has such a distinctive voice. It's so passionate and complex and earnest, really. So I love this one. I could definitely be inspired to write a poem listening to it. And frogs. I mean, what the hell? Frogs. I mean, just bring up frogs and put them in a poem. So, again, I suppose what we haven't talked about is how, like, a great poem and a great song, neither of them have to make absolute sense. They have to make not logical sense on the page that a scientist would find or a linguist, but sense that is made inside the reader or the listener. And I think Nick Cave definitely does that. Along with Dylan.
Yeah, a lot of images there.
Yeah.
And to call your song Frogs, I mean, like, It's the most anti-commercial statement you can make.
Yes. To get back to Scott Heron, what I also liked about that song was the anti-commercialism, you know, the driving kind of let's get rid of all of this advertising and this common way of thinking. And yes, frogs. Let's have more frogs and more revolution.
I have a very soft spot for Nick Cave because I actually met him once in London. We were at a restaurant. We both got up to pay our bills. I saw him across the way, didn't interrupt or anything silly like that. But we both happened to get up to pay our bills at the same time.
You'd be waiting for him to get up.
No, actually, it's very dumb. Anyway, we sort of bumped in. And I just said to him, hi, Nick Cave, I'm a great fan. And he grunted. But you know, it was a terrible moment because, of course, after that, I've relived the moment 1,000 times. And I thought of what I should have said. And what I should have said was, if you don't believe in an interventionist God, do you believe in a non-interventionist God, or do you believe in an interventionist non-God? Because that would have started a whole conversation and we would be friends today. But unfortunately, that's not what happened.
If somebody is who you admire isn't very friendly to you, does that change your opinion of the music? Or not
in the slightest. Not in the slightest. Okay. I mean, one appreciates that, you know, he gets 1,000 people walking up to him and
saying that
and
kind
I
of
sort
thing.
Of felt I felt I'd overstayed my welcome just by saying hello.
And the fact that you're a fan, I mean, you thought.
No. It seems ridiculous to be a fan, but what is wrong with being a fan? I mean, you know, it's important to be a fan, I think.
But how long ago was this?
20 years. Okay. I don't know, but it was a very hip restaurant in Notting Hill in London.
A friend of mine once interviewed him, and he in one of the songs he uses a very strange bird. I forgot which one. And so he thought he'd break the ice with starting to talk about that bird that Cave uses in the song. And he immediately opened up. You know, there were no questions about drugs or anything, but about a lyric, a specific lyric, and a bird within that lyric. And he loved it. So they became great buddies for that 1.5 hour that they spoke. So maybe you should have mentioned the bird.
You know, but I mean, I know that if I had tried to sort of say, you know, do you believe in a non-interventionist God? I would have got it completely messed up.
Too complex. He would have corrected you.
Exactly.
I was thinking of choosing that song, Into My Arms. What I think is so funny about the great opening line, wow, what a stunning opening line. That would be a dream beginning to a poem. He says he doesn't believe in an interventionist God, but then he starts telling the angels what to do. And, you know, them's go and make sure that not a hair on your head is harmed and so on. So is he or isn't he a deist?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. He has changed. As you can imagine, of course, because having two of your children die, you know, Into My Arms is another example of the protection, providing protection, which obviously is, you know, he must feel a fantastic lack now, having had two children die. Anyway. All right. On with much less sadness.
Well, the moon is broken. And the sky is cracked. Come on to the house. The only thing that you can see is all that you lack. Come on up to the house. All your crying don't do no good. Come on up to the house. Come down off the cross, we can use the wood. You gotta come on up to the house. Come on up to the house. Come on up to the house. The world is not my home, I'm just a passer.
I just love it. I love his cajoling tone. My favorite line of all time is, come down off the cross, we could use the wood. I actually saw Tom Waits live in the 1990s in Paris. My then boyfriend and I were just looking to see what was on in Paris that night. And so we went along and queued in this huge theater, and they suddenly opened a new desk to sell tickets, and they pointed directly at us, and we were brought right to the front and got the most marvelous seat in one of those kind of opera boxes. And to see Tom Waits perform from there, it was, yeah, that was extraordinary. And it is a performance. What he does is a real, genuine performance.
Was he with a band or solo?
He was with a whole ensemble, yeah. Okay. He was completely supported, yeah. Mm. You know, in Afrikaans, there's this word gooi, and it's like, that's what I sometimes want to tell my poetry students. You're like, get rid of your inhibitions, just gooi, you know, just go in. And for me, that's what Tom Waits does in this song. And I think it's like, for me, it's like an anthem, like, stop being so prissy, so difficult, so standoffish, you know, come. And we don't know, like, listening to the song, we don't know what the house is. It could be like, stop sulking in the yard, come up to the house. But I think the house might actually be like where the party is.
Or the conversation, or the conviviality, or the friendship, or the, you know, it's a great analogy for so many different things. And you've certainly got your out there confident singer in Mr. Waits. I just think he's extraordinary. He's extraordinary for all kinds of reasons, and one of which is he had a fantastically good thing going, being the truck stop bar singer. You know, he could have stuck with that for his entire life and made a fantastically good living and become progressively more famous. But what did he do? He sort of chucked it up and went into a kind of adventures in sound and, you know, fantastically clever, creative, unusual, and just nonstop, you know, a complete truck through the middle of, you know, the genre. And along the way, just sort of cast off these kind of gems, you know, while he was smashing through conventions. It's interesting to me also that his songs are so popular for movies. A lot of his songs have ended up being theme songs for TV series and for movies. And I don't know why that is. I think he's very visual. He's very attention grabbing. The subject matter is always fun. And he's got a little sense of humor about everything, which just brings it all together.
Also instantly recognizable. I mean, you hear his voice, you know, it's Tom Waits. It's like,
yeah, he's branded.
Yeah, no, I think humor and wit, and it's so important because, like, even in a sad poem, there should be wit. And I mean, like, that, you know, wit isn't just ha-ha funny. Wit is being really clever with words. And I think that, yeah, we've heard a lot of that today on the songs we've heard.
Well, the next one isn't very witty.
Yeah, no, not witty, no, no. But Fanula, you like the fact that it's, you know, it's not a sort of a retiring lyricist at all.
I'm a streetwalking cheetah with a hat full of napalm. I'm a runaway son of the nuclear A-bomb. I am the world's forgotten boy, the one who searches and destroys.
Fred, Iggy Pop, Search and Destroy, tell us about it.
Stooges, huh? That was before he became a solo artist. I love Iggy is such an uninhibited performer and singer. I mean, what you see is what you get. He doesn't mind conventions. He steps out of line whenever he can. I think the lyrics, I mean, they're not poetic in that sense that some of the others were poetic. But I think opening line, I'm a street walking cheetah with a heart full of napalm. I'm a runaway son of a nuclear A-bomb. I'm the world's forgotten boy, the one who searches and destroys, is quite a good opening line. I think that's quite great. And it gives me, it's a bit like the Patti Smith, but in slightly differently. It gives me always lots of energy. When I play that song, I think, yeah, I can tackle the world. I can do anything I want. And of course, Iggy, he did anything he wanted. I mean, he's still singing. He's still with us, despite everything he's done to his body. His voice is now like a chansonnier almost. His voice is much lower and he sings sort of torch songs, I guess, which you would call them. But he's got such an impressive career. And if you hear and see him in interviews, he's actually a really, really sweet guy, very well read. He's a bit of an intellectual. So he had the wild years, and this was certainly during the wild years, but he developed. He didn't get stuck in that sort of proto-punk personage. Yeah, I love Iggy, but I particularly love the Stooges era more than anything. And this is my favorite Iggy song, I think.
There's actually even like a primal scream in the song, which I think is great because there's this connection. In a way, poetry is like a scream. It's, you know, like Ginsberg's long poem, Howl, and Whitman saying, I sound my barbaric yawp. There's some sense in which poetry is a scream, a shout. You know, it's actually fundamentally inarticulate. It's an inarticulate feeling which you then articulate. I love that. And that's a great head-banging song. It makes you want to dance. You used the word dervish for an earlier song, but I feel like there's a dervishness going on here. Yeah, I think what I like about this song is it would make me want to cut loose. That feeling of that I need to write a poem, which is I need to separate from everything that is ordered and tidy and conventional. Mm. And I must break free, you know?
This song is about having no inhibitions. I think that's the message. And the lyrics are good. I like them.
Well, I must say, you two are very convincing arguers because I was about to argue that this song is completely, totally wrong, that it would never make me want to write poetry. It would want me to kind of, you know, go and get drunk or something. I don't know. I mean, but what you say is completely correct. I stand corrected.
But it's also, the main theme, of course, is the world forgotten boy, which is if you're struggling with something, you feel like the world's forgotten boy or girl. And the way Iggy gets out of that gives you energy and power to get, a writer's block or whatever. And you think, well, I'm also the street walking cheetah with a heart full of napalm. So, you know, it gives you that extra bit of power that you need in difficult days, I think.
Yeah, you need
You know, the one argument against it would be, you know, that the term search and destroy, you know, it's a very military term. You know, it's not about...
Well, it came from the military.
Yeah, it's not... you're not being nice here. You're, you know, going out to sort of maim, hurt, generally destruct. I think that you have to put that into the...
I think he's satirizing military speak. You know, he's sending it up. This napalming and everything. I mean, he's embracing it in a metaphorical sense, the energy of weapons, but not the real weapons. Apparently, he took some of the lines straight off a military website.
It's about confidence and, you know, and getting on top of the world and, you know, feeling powerful and all of those things, I would guess.
I also love his voice. He's got an incredible, good rock and roll voice, certainly on this song. It's like a proto-punk voice.
Yeah, that's right. And Finula, as you say, he's got that yelp, which was so important in early punk. You know, it's impressive. It's no question. Great, great artist.
Okay.
All right, last song.
Yeah, it was beautiful. Am bal for this, and that was so verskrik, en verskrik lief vir jou, en ek en jy het op grafte en op treine, op voort verlei einde, sy achtersiets gevry, en nou is jy en jou man, both computer analysts, and last winter, you tried to cut above your wrist, en nou skryf jy vir my, jy kan nie meer slaap, nie, nie,
anymore. It's for yourself and me, I'm not quite there. For my soon need.
This is Tens Yordan's version of Beautiful in Beaufort West. I just really think Tens Yordan's rendition of it is just fantastic. I mean, it goes completely opposite to everything we've been talking about. I think you're both going to jump on me. I won't blame you if you do. It's more like, you know, a sort of invitation to self-destruct than, than an invitation to beat the world at their own game. I just find this beautiful. I love the fact that it's written by somebody from the area in which I live, talking about places in which I go. I love the fact that it's so tragic and that it just sort of reaches out and touches this humanity and frailty and does it in such a sparse and penetrating kind of way. It's just extraordinary. I mean, it's a very old song now, just by the way. I am interested in the process of going from a poem to a song. I think that progression is very interesting, because they are such different things and they don't seem like different things until you try and turn poetry into song. And then suddenly you realize, actually, this is not the same.
I think Gert Floknel really makes that transition so brilliantly. I think you can see his songs in a poetry book and they look exactly like poems. They read like poems. Sometimes song lyrics, when printed, can look a little vacant because of all the repetition, because the bridge is very often a simplified thing, and because of all the words like baby and kind of, there's a kind of kitschiness in some song lyrics.
All the oohs and ahs.
Yeah, shooby-doo. Although I think I put shooby-doo into a poem. this song is beautiful and would be a good reminder for me about how important it is to feel free to write poems that are completely indigenous and close to home. And also that, I mean, it's something that's come up in some of the other songs we've listened to, is the importance of the direct address, like you got in the Tom Waits song. One of the most beautiful things a poem can do, and songs do it too, is to say you. You don't get that in novels. A novelist will never begin the novel, or hardly ever begin a novel, saying you. You is just not there. And this is the great similarity between this call, this kind of conversation, this warm address to a person who you, as the reader or the listener, you think it's you. And the other thing I was going to say is, you know, we mustn't forget that gossip, like there is something gossipy in the lyrics here, you know, and you slit your wrist, you know, stuff that you should be private being made public. And poetry also embraces that. Like there's a kind of sense of either gossip or confession. Confession works really well in poetry. So yeah, no, I'm not going to jump on you. I thank you for introducing me to the song.
I wonder why you chose his version and not Gert Floknel's.
I just thought his rendition was great. I just thought, and also, you know, he's also dead.
Oh, yeah, we're just dead. Because I think Gert Floknel's version is actually better. It's more basic, it's sparse, and here you get the sort of orchestration, which makes it slightly schmaltzy for me.
Yes, no, that's possible. I mean, the version that he sings, that Tens Yordan sings, is very much the same version of Gert Floknel. It's not different at all melodically. He takes the melody straight from him.
Yeah.
He's just a bit of a better singer, I think. But nobody, you know, this was, you know, it was written in, you know, 2000. Tens Yordan's first album, which he, you know, just like 25 years ago. And it's taken an enormous amount of time to reach kind of popularity. But, you know, I walked into the Pick and Pay in Utsun recently, and there was the song. You know, it's very current now, and it's wonderful that such a great song is sort of finding itself after all this time. I don't know.
He was huge in Holland for a while, Gert Floknel, because they made that documentary about him. They went to Beaufort West and they filmed in very stark, sort of almost black and white. I forgot that it's color black, but it could have been black and white, even if it had been color. And they got atmosphere of that sort of little town, a trucker stop halfway on the way to Joburg. It was a sad place, and there's a sort of sad hotel and where he used to come and drink. And it was released on Dutch television, and he became an instant star in Holland, and he sold out the Paradiso Club, etc. And he was invited every year at poetry conferences. But I think, I don't know, he never made another proper album after that, which is very sad.
Yeah, I mean, he's still around, he's still singing, and he's still writing poetry. You're sort of very much along the same kind of lines, you know, also about George and the garden route, and, you know, and also about Fraying. I think Fraying is a particular interest of his. And I think he's still popular in Holland.
It's, yeah, well, it is a great song. I forgot about it. It's almost a country song, isn't it?
Yeah.
James Jordan did it.
Yeah. And quite simple lyrics and quite simple sort of guitar playing melodic structure. Oh. But just beautiful. All right. So now the time has come to make a choice. And I have to say, you know, last week, Fred and I were about the perfect song for kissing. I thought that we hadn't found a single song that was any good. I have to say, out of this collection, honestly, I could choose anyone. I mean, I would be happy with anyone. Fionnuala, what we try and do, because it's always hard, is we try and drop one of our own songs to make it easier for the others. And then we drop one of each other's songs to try and isolate the perfect song. But if you have a sort of choice that you are absolutely determined is the best song, just by all means, shout.
No, I'm happy to. So it's hard to drop a song. I'll drop the Dylan because...
No, don't!
Yes.
No, go ahead.
I'll drop the Dylan because it's... Although it's got the drum and the bass that I need to change my heart rhythms, it doesn't actually have that emotional call that the other two have, that, you know, voice call to be be yourself, be inside your be true to yourself. So it's just I don't want to just pick the song because of the drumming and the bass.
Fred?
Okay, I'll drop Iggy then, because I know it's not going to win anyway, because you won't vote for it.
Maybe I will. I can change my mind. All right. Well, I mean, I'll drop anyone if you like. I mean, I don't mind. I suppose I'll drop the Gil Scott-Heron. As you say, it wasn't an interesting song for lots of reasons, but it doesn't, in fact, inspire you to write poetry. Maybe it gives you an example. All right. Any other songs that we think are definitely out?
No, but I wanted to say that my favorite is the Cat Power song because it's my favorite song of all times. But for this purpose, for this podcast, I do think Nina Simone's interpretation of the Judy Collins song works very well, for me at least. So I would vote for that to be the winner.
Yeah, you know, I would agree with you there. I love that Cat Power song and I was going to vote for it. But for me, the Nina Simone song's really right in the same ballpark. So I'd be very happy to go with the Nina Simone song.
That's the second time Nina Simone would win.
Nina Simone can win a lot.
And you, Fionnuala,
and Bob Dylan could win a lot as well.
Yeah, I'd be very happy for Nina Simone to win. And then I promise to listen to Cat Power and try to listen to it through your ears, Fred, when I've finished writing the poem. I'm going to go there.
Okay. Well, that's the compromise then.
Okay. Well, that wasn't as difficult as I thought, although it seems so sad to have not chosen the Tom Waits song and the Nick Cave song. Anyway, this has been a fantastic conversation. It's been a complete treat. Thank you so much for joining us. It's a real privilege.
And we learned a lot about poetry as well.
Yeah, we did. And can I ask you a question, though? Do you believe in
an interventionist God? Yes, I mean, that's an interesting question. I do believe that there seem to be interventions which could be caused by magnetic disturbances. Even if there were absolutely no God at all, the world would still be a miracle. It would be a miracle that we have temperature we can live in and forests and seas that we enjoy. So I think there is something out there. And that's what poetry is all about, the transcendent, the impossible. So I have to go with it. There's some godliness.
Okay. Well, Fred, it's your choice for next time.
Oh,
you thought of something that you'd like to talk about?
I had two thoughts, because you talked about hip-hop earlier with Gil Scott-Heron. I thought three songs to help you understand hip-hop. three songs for understanding hip. I'm not a big hip hop fan, to be honest, but I can pick three songs that would appeal to me and sort of help me understand hip hop. But I'm not going to say I detest hip hop, but I'm not a fan whatsoever. So that's going to be a difficult one for me. And then I also had a very obvious one. It's three songs for the perfect Saturday night or three songs for the perfect Sunday morning. So which one would you pick of the three?
Wow. I mean, I think they're both really nice.
We can, of course, do those somewhere. Sometime.
Yeah, in sequence. Let's do the hip hop one because I've been listening to a lot of hip hop now. And
that's why I thought it might be.
Yeah. I mean, it's hip hop's fabulous. I mean, it's just fantastic.
Okay, we're going to argue about that.
Yes, obviously. All right. Well, thanks for listening. If you've listened so far, please remember that you can email us your selections or choices or agreements or disagreements to perfectsong4@gmail.com. We're on all of the socials, of course. We welcome ideas and participants, of course. We even have a Patreon if you're feeling generous, because it does take a little bit of money to kind of put all of the stuff together. We'll obviously link to Fanula's work, which I'm looking forward to now that I've heard where it's going. All right, cheers, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, Fanula.
My father always promised me